You're listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC, Boston College. Today is Sunday, June 14th, 2026. Before we step into this hour, a brief reminder for our listeners. The reflections you hear today rise from the voices of our hosts and guests alone. They are shaped by their experiences, their convictions, and their search for truth. They do not represent the official views of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. What you hear in this space is unfiltered. What you hear in this space is honest. What you hear in this space belongs to the people who speak it. And now, with that clarity set before us, we begin. This Week in Palestine is not a place where truth whispers. It does not creep in quietly or wait for permission to speak. Here, truth walks straight into the room, unhidden, unafraid, carrying its full weight for all to see. Urgency is not a mood in this space. It is the pulse beneath every sentence. Clarity is not a luxury. It is the responsibility we shoulder every time we open this microphone. And while our heart remains rooted in Palestine, in the West Bank, in Gaza, our gaze stretches far beyond the map. Because the forces shaping Palestinian life do not stop at borders. They move across continents, across capitals, across the quiet corners of the world where decisions are made behind closed doors. Wherever you are listening from, whether guiding your car through the long hours of the night, lifting your first cup of coffee into the morning light, or sitting in the stillness of your home, thank you for choosing to be here. I am your host and narrator, Arlene Russell. In this space, we do not polish the edges of reality. We do not soften the truth to make it easier to swallow. We do not rewrite the story to make it more comfortable for those who prefer silence. This is a place where truth stands unfiltered, where resistance is not an idea, but a daily act of survival. Where solidarity is not a slogan, but an inheritance carried from one generation to the next. The voices rising from occupied land remain steady. They rise beside movements around the world that demand dignity, justice, and liberation. They remind us that struggle is never isolated. It is connected, intertwined, woven through the lives of people who refuse to surrender their humanity. This hour is not simply a broadcast. It is a lifeline, a thread stretching from Palestine to every corner of the globe, tying devastation to determination, tying grief to a future still worth reaching for. Even in the deepest darkness, the ember of defiance survives. Even when the world turns away, that ember refuses to die. Each week, we bring you reporting that cuts through distortion, analysis that refuses disguise, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, complexity, and unbroken courage. We speak with intention because the stakes demand nothing less. This Week in Palestine is not a refuge for polite silence. It is testimony. It is urgency. It is solidarity without hesitation. The struggle for freedom is shared, it crosses borders, and it remains sacred. Today, we bring you a voice that carries the weight of history, not from the margins, but from the very heart of the Zionist project itself. Micho Peled, the grandson of one of Israel's founding generals, sits down and says the words the world was never supposed to hear. This is the end of Israel. A man raised inside the myth, inside the military elite, inside the story Israel tells about itself, now dismantling that story piece by piece. He speaks about the lies he inherited, the truths he uncovered, and the moral collapse he watched from within. And when someone with his lineage says the project is crumbling, the world should pay attention. This isn't just an interview. This is testimony from the family album of the state itself. Let's step into the conversation.
Today joining us is Mr. Micho Peled. He's a man whose grandfather signed the Declaration of Independence for Israel. His father was a general in the Six-Day War for Israel and the Arab states. And in 1997, Miko's sister tragically lost her daughter in a suicide bombing in Jerusalem. This tragedy is what finally drove Miko to embark on his journey to discover Palestine. And today he's sitting with me here today in Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C., in Dar al-Hurriya, Palestine House of Freedom, in which you started and you organized. And I'm so curious, man, how you went from the grandson of one of the people that signed the Declaration of Israel's Independence, Israel's generals, and today leading the House of Freedom in Palestine and Washington, D.C. First of all, thank you and welcome for joining the Ansari podcast.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure. Well, it's a long story, and that's why there's the book, The General's Son, which describes the journey. It's called The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. So the book has the full story. But the short version is I began meeting Palestinians. So I was born and raised in Jerusalem, and they like to call Jerusalem a mixed city, but it's not a mixed city. It's a completely segregated city, not unlike all of Palestine. I mean, the apartheid regime created a segregation between Israelis and Palestinians, a complete segregation. So even growing up in the same city, you know, you don't meet Palestinians. I mean, you live a completely different reality than they do. And then, like you mentioned, as a result of the tragedy that my family had gone through, I realized that there's a piece missing in the puzzle, in terms of what I knew and understood about that country. Which at that time I still called it Israel, and that realization drove me to start engaging with Palestinians and meeting Palestinians and seeking out opportunities to meet Palestinians. Because why would anybody, you know, three young men kill themselves and in such a tragic way and so on? And so it drove me to try to understand what kind of a reality was created for Palestinians by the fact that the apartheid regime was there and pretended to be a legitimate state. So I started, actually here in the United States, the chapter that talks about the journey in the book starts with a line, something along the line, my journey to meet Palestinians began in the United States. So that was the first time I met Palestinians, you know, sitting around and talking like humans, like, you know, normal people. And so then when in my, I would, you know, I travel back and forth to Palestine all the time. And then I started engaging with Palestinians and traveling into Palestinian cities, both within 1948 and, you know, all parts of Palestine, basically. And that what eventually got me to the point where I understood what is going on and what this horrible tragedy of the apartheid regime created in Palestine and for Palestinians. And so it went from being what I was taught, which is the creation of this regime was heroic and was connected to Jewish history and had all this, you know, mythology built around it, to rejecting it because realizing what it really was, what it was meant to do and what it really did. And of course, there's a history of almost 100 years now in Palestine of this regime, and we know what it's done. So basically, that's the short version of the story of the journey.
Why, though, did you decide to learn about the Palestinians rather than choose to hate them? I mean, if your sister's child gets killed, a normal person's reaction would be to feel anger and hatred towards the Palestinians.
Well, anger and frustration for sure, but it wasn't pointed at Palestinians. It was pointed at the root cause of the violence, which is the apartheid regime, which is the Israeli government. And in fact, my sister, so when this happened, it was big news over there. I flew to Jerusalem and, you know, spent the time with my family and so on, the funeral. And it was big news. It was front page news that the granddaughter of, you know, so-and-so was killed in a suicide bombing and so on. And so right off the bat, And you know, journalists were everywhere and from all over the world. And so right off the bat, my sister said two things. Number one, she said, don't talk to me about revenge, because killing more people in response to the death of a child is completely madness. It's completely insane. It makes no sense. And number two, she said that she holds the government, the Israeli government, responsible for her daughter's death. And so there's no such thing as they, the Palestinians, right? Three young men did this and killed themselves. And so if you want to understand the root cause of something, you have to look and find out what is the source of the violence, what can cause people to do something so tragic. So obviously the fingers are pointed at, and it was what's interesting is Netanyahu was prime minister then too. He was prime minister there for a while and then came back. So to me, that made the most sense, is to engage and find out what kind of reality exists on that other side that would bring somebody to do something like this.
Why then don't most Israelis think this way? I mean, they do see the Palestinians as they, and way worse than they. They see them as less than animals. Why don't they see it like this as well?
That's a question that is, it's a very good question. I can't explain it. I mean, I had undergone the same kind of education as all Israelis, where Palestinians are either non-existent, or they're terrorists, or they're, you know, backward refugees. And I mean, you know, they don't really exist. We see them, they go in and out of the frame as construction workers or, you know, doing the landscaping, but we never meet the Palestinians. And then at 18, you're suddenly told that, you know, they're the enemy and we have to protect ourselves against them. But
I thought they indoctrinated you as a child to hating the Palestinians.
Well,
it's not Israel.
It's not a question of hating. It's a question that they don't exist. And when they do exist, they're a threat to our survival. Mm. They're an existential threat to our survival. So it's worse than hate. Now there's a lot of hate being expressed as well. But I never sensed that there was that hate was the issue. The threat was the issue. Fear was the issue. And so that was the driving force. And so why are Israelis, you know, acting in this, you know, psychotic way as a society? That's something that people are going to have to study in the future to figure out how they were able to, how this education system that was put in place, by the way, you know, long before the state was established. I mean, my parents were born in Palestine in the 20s, and there was already a Zionist education system.
From 1920s.
Yeah. So they went to school from pre-K through university. There was an entire education system already in place. And so it's, I would venture to say, number one, it's a success of the education system, that it created exactly the kind of people that they needed, that they wanted to execute the plan. And number two, as a member of society, this is what you hear, this is what you see, this is what you learn, this is what you hear other people say. And so that's what you are, that's what you become. I mean, it's very powerful, and it's a small country. You know, I always compare Israeli society to German society during the Nazi regime. This is something that people don't talk about, but there was a very significant resistance, German resistance, to the Nazis. And they were all sent to concentration camps and killed, like, immediately and executed. Nobody ever talks about that, the German resistance to the Nazis. There were small groups, larger groups, there were individuals. That doesn't exist. There's no Israeli resistance to Zionism. There is no resistance against Zionism. And I think one day somebody will have to study these and maybe compare these two societies to figure out how one has been so successfully indoctrinated to be violent and cruel to the other, whereas in Germany, even with the indoctrination and even with the violence and with the threat of violence, in other words, Germans who resisted knew what their fate would be when they were caught, and they were all caught. If Israelis, you know, stood up and marched and spoke against it, they wouldn't be killed. They wouldn't be sent to a concentration camp. And yet they don't do it. There is no threat. So I don't know. You'd have to, you know, I'm not a sociologist, but that's the reality.
Have you ever spoken to your grandfather about Israeli
society? No. He passed away before I was born.
Oh, he passed away before you were born. How about your father?
My father passed away before I became involved in this issue. He passed away 2 years before my niece was killed. So, I mean, I knew his thoughts and so forth. We were kind of a liberal Zionist family. You know, he talked about the two-state solution and that sort of thing. He became very well known for that. And he also became an outcast because of that. Because immediately after the 1967 war, although more than a war, it was just a brutal assault by the apartheid regime against its neighbors. I mean, it was not called for. And it ended in 5 days. He immediately said, now we need to let the Palestinians establish a state in the West Bank and Gaza and make peace and move on. But immediately the establishment started building cities and towns for Jews, Israeli Jews only throughout the West Bank and the newly occupied territories. And he kind of became an outcast, and that was his path. The two-state solution was kind of his path. He met with Yasser Arafat. I mean, he was very much involved in this. But I never spoke to him as somebody who is involved in this the way I am now, because he had already gone.
What do you think his reaction would be to what you've done since?
Well, I think, you know, I think that he would support the idea of dismantling the apartheid regime and establishing a democracy with equal rights. And the reason I think that, I mean, he was a Zionist to his dying day. He believed in Zionism firmly. But he was also a forward thinker. I mean, today people still talk about the two-state solution as though it's a legitimate kind of idea. You know, back in the day when he talked about it, nobody wanted to talk to him. So he foresaw that this was something, you know, when people didn't want to talk about it, he was already talking about it. So my sense is that he would probably be, again, on the sidelines saying the kinds of things that we're saying here, that only a dismantling of the apartheid regime, only the liberation of Palestine and the right of return and the establishing of free democratic Palestine is the only option that really benefits everyone who lives in historic Palestine today.
A one-state solution where it becomes Palestine again, where Muslims, Christians, Jews all live together, Hindus, atheists, just like it used to be.
Well, there are not a lot of Hindus there, but yeah. Yeah. Basically, I mean, the one state is there. It's one. All of Palestine is one state.
Right.
It was that way since 1967. Done. It was over. But, of course, it's an apartheid regime. So getting dismantling the apartheid regime and allowing a real free democratic Palestine to take its place.
How come no one talks about a one-state solution? I think that's the only solution there is. I believe Imam Tom Fichini, I don't know if you've heard of him, he talked about how there's like four outcomes to colonization, the Algerian-French outcome where the colonized kick out the colonizer, the American Indian outcome or Native American outcome where the colonizer wins and completely genocides, and then the South African outcome where it becomes one state. He said there's never, I think it's only three then, he said there's never been a fourth solution where you make this two state and all of this mumbo jumbo, this crap.
Well, the two state is what they tried to do with the Native Americans here. And of course we know how well that goes. So that went. But I don't think that nobody talks. A lot of people talk about it. I mean, this was the initial platform of the PLO, of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, was a democracy, a single democracy with equal rights. This was their initial platform, and gradually they were pressured into accepting the two-state solution, recognizing the apartheid regime as a legitimate state, and so on. But this has been the Palestinian platform. And today, I don't know. I mean, I have many friends and comrades, Palestinian activists, grassroots leaders in Palestine. Many of them are part of Dar Hurriya. You know, they've given their name to it. We all agree. We all talk about this. Nobody talks about anything but that.
The one state solution. It's the only political.
There is, yeah. I mean, the only people who talk about two states are either people who know that it's an impossibility, and they also know that talking about it allows the apartheid regime to kill more Palestinians and take over more Palestinian land. Because as long as you talk about it, it pretends like you want peace. Or other people talk about it, and I meet many of those people at the Capitol when I visit, when I meet people there, they don't know what other possibility, in other words, they haven't heard of other possibilities, and they're wondering, well, how's that going to work? So one of the things that we do with our outreach program, we as in Palestine House of Freedom, is to demonstrate that first of all, there can be no two states. There's no West Bank, really. I mean, the idea that there's a West Bank is a myth. There's no West Bank. It's been completely integrated into the rest of the country, into the rest of the kind of the Zionist state. And so we need to come to terms with that. It's been, you know, they talk about, you know, will they annex? Will they not annex? They've annexed it a long time ago, you know. But so to demonstrate that not only is that not a solution that is possible, but there is a better solution which will benefit everyone who lives, like I said, in historic Palestine, and that is dismantling the apartheid state. Because this vision of Israelis and Palestinians living in peace, living coexisting, it can happen. I think it's realistic. But it's not going to happen as long as it's an apartheid regime that is in control of Palestine. A real liberated Palestine with equal rights, with the right of return, will allow that to happen. Nothing else will allow that to happen. So that's really the outreach. That's what we focus on when we talk to people. So they understand that there is a solution. We're just not working to get there. I mean, we are, but you know, the halls of power, they haven't quite come to terms with that.
Yeah,
but I believe they will, and sooner than most people think.
I think anyone within the Palestinian movement that's pretty much ignorant about what we're talking about, how the two-state solution is actually killing Palestinians, should know that we should really focus in on this one-state solution because it's politically powerful. It's telling us, well, why don't we all just live together as one, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, all together, and like how we used to. That's way more powerful than give us our own land, give us our own property, get out of the West Bank, get out of Gaza. Like that all of that tit for tat's not going to really work. We just need one message of peace, one state. I believe I think it was, I forget his name, something Harai, or he's like a Jewish thinker. And he was saying if the Palestinian movement starts asking for a South African solution, Israeli government is in trouble. The Zionist state is in trouble, which I believe is true.
Well,
Yuval Harari.
Right now, there's no real representation for the Palestinian. There's no real Palestinian representatives anywhere, other than in Palestine and the grassroots activists that are there. But I mean, like as a central authority. But the South African model is the model that people around, you know, that I talk to, that we work with, that's the model that we talk about. When you look back at the encampments that took place all across the country, that was what people talked about. And then the People's Forum for Palestine, which followed the encampments, it already happened twice, it was 2 years in a row already. That's the only thing people talk about. So it's growing, and people are understanding that that is the only way forward. It just hasn't reached the halls of power. It hasn't reached, there's no critical mass yet, and there's no understanding in the halls of power that it's, if anybody does care about the well-being of all people who live in Palestine, then there's a very clear path to that. And the South Africans, they laid out a very good model. They laid out a very good roadmap.
Professor John Mearsheimer from University of Chicago, he said that we've never seen anything like the Zionist Israeli Jews. We've never seen a democratic genocide. He said you can even make some excuse for the Nazis and that the people, like you said, majority may have not even known, may have heard whispers, never actually seen it or felt it or even smelled it. He said you can even make an excuse for ISIS in that it doesn't smile while killing the people that they kill or beheading the people that they behead. They're not smiling. At least they look angry. He said, we've never seen a people collectively enjoy death, enjoy murder, enjoy killing. This is from John Mearsheimer. I'm kind of quoting him, but this is basically what he said. What do you think is going on there? I know you kind of touched on it earlier.
Look, I mean, I don't think they invented anything new. I mean, apartheid has been, you know. But what's perhaps is new, and I agree, is the popular support for the genocide. Now, you have to understand, people say, oh, the Israeli society has gone far to the right. They're so much more extreme. It's not true. If you look at what the founders of Zionism said, what the founders of the regime in 1948 said, what every Israeli politician has said for the last 100 years, what is happening now is a direct line. There has been no shift. The attempt and the desire to get rid of Palestinians, to commit genocide, to commit ethnic cleansing, that is the very foundation of the regime, of this, you know, the so-called State of Israel. That was the foundation. Between 1947 and 1949, there was a massive campaign. You know, almost 1 million people were thrown out. God only knows how many were massacred. You know, villages were burned and destroyed, and everything was stolen. Cities were stolen. Towns were stolen. Produce in the fields was stolen. Cars, money that people had in the banks. I mean, Palestine was a developed country. You know, all that was stolen. And that was the foundation, and that is the moment that Israelis feel very proud of. In other words, the identity of Israelis is directly tied to that crime, which they describe as an act of heroism. You know, so there's nothing new here. This is exactly, and Israeli society, people knew about the Nakba. They knew about what happened in those years. Hell, they participated. Their parents participated. But they managed to convey it in a way that gave you a sense of pride. You know, we were the few, they were the many. They wanted to kill us. We just wanted to live. And, you know, we had a right to come back because we were nationless, you know, the Jewish people and all that, which is all mythology. So that is the very foundation of Israeli society. So the genocide that we're seeing now is really just a heightened expression of genocide, of what we've seen since the very beginning, over the last, I would say, 100 years in Palestine.
We now see Israeli soldiers wearing Greater Israel patches on their arms. And Netanyahu and most of Israeli society has been talking about this concept of Greater Israel for a while now. And at the same time, today's March 18th that we're filming this on Thursday, where I think the Prime Minister of Qatar just came out and said that they're losing patience for the Iranians, right? As we know, the Iran war is happening right now. And I'm wondering, do the Arabs not see what's happening? Will the Arabs actually get fooled into getting into this war and fighting Iran, losing its resources, losing its oil infrastructure? Because Iran's definitely going to bomb all of their oil refineries, which will completely collapse their economies. Iran will also bomb their water salination, whatever that word.
Salination. Yeah, of course, they already did, yeah.
I think they did it in the last 24 hours. Yeah. But they're going to continue to do so, which will render the societies unlivable in, uncivilized, these Arab nations. So the only winner of that would be Israel, because Arab nations will all be destroyed. Iran will be destroyed in the meantime, because Israel will use those foot soldiers, these Arab foot soldiers, the American foot soldiers, to try to get into Iran. Doesn't matter to them that they're in the meat grinder. And then Israel can then move on to project its power and create Greater Israel. It's already moving into southern Lebanon. It's already thinking ahead about Turkey. I mean, do these Arab leaders not see this?
No, they see it. But, there's two answers to that. One is that the regimes that govern the Arab states are obviously not democratic regimes. And so they're beholden to the United States and to the apartheid, the Zionist state, of course, sadly. And they've been working.
Beholden to it how?
Well, they've been working together for a long time. These regimes rely on the United States for security. They rely on the apartheid state for security, for all kinds of things, to protect the regimes. Now, the other part of it is, if you are a leader of an Arab country today, and you look around you, what do you see? You see two options. You see the option that they took in Iraq and in Syria and in Libya and in Yemen, which is a solidly pro-Palestinian stance. And look at these countries now. So is that a good choice for your country as the leader of that country? Or do you need to find a way to walk the fine line and survive and make sure that your country isn't blasted off the face of the earth and chaos created and so on, which is what happens, of course, in all these countries that I mentioned. So it's, I think it's unfair to judge the Arab states. I judge the Europeans, because the Europeans and the Americans are the ones who are supporting this, and they're the ones who can stop it, and they choose not to. The Arab states are between a rock and a hard place. The Europeans are paying and supporting for the genocide of the Palestinian people, and of course America, the United States. And so I think that's why we're seeing what we're seeing. And now look, their defenses were taken away to help the apartheid state against the retaliation by Iran, and they're defenseless. And they're pretty small anyway, so they're defenseless anyway. They rely on the United States to defend them. And the United States is not a reliable ally, we know that. So that's the reality in which they exist. So it's not that they don't see it. The question is, strategically, if your responsibility is to defend your own country, how do you want to end up?
I mean, the United States is also between a rock and a hard place, because the most peculiar thing happened this week, where Trump is allowing Russian oil. He has removed sanctions off of Russian oil, which is allowing Russia's economy to be funded to continue the war in Ukraine, which is another proxy war between the United States and Ukraine. And then it's also allowing Iranian ships through the Strait of Hormuz to sell to India and China and the rest of the world to make sure that oil prices stay $100 or less. That's the litmus test that Trump is going on, $100 or less. So he's letting Iran make money, he's letting Russia make money, and he's having the United States and Israel and the Europeans lose money. And all of this for a war in Iran that we don't even necessarily need. As you and I have seen this week, John Kent, the Secretary of National Security for Counterterrorism.
Director, yeah.
A director has just resigned and gave out this letter basically saying, I did so because we're fighting a war in Iran for Israel. Now, obviously, all the Zionists are attacking him, Mark Levin, Ben Shapiro, and the rest. He immediately went on the Tucker Carlson show and laid out everything. I mean, I don't know if you watched that episode.
I didn't see the Tucker Carlson, but I read the letter, and of course he's going to be attacked. This whole mad reality was created by the United States and its support for the apartheid regime. I mean, the sanctions against Russia don't make any sense. The advance of NATO towards Russia, moving east, which the Russians were promised would not happen when Germany was united, happened. So in other words, this war was forced on the world by the United States. Of course, the attack in Iran makes no sense to anyone. It makes no sense to anyone. I mean, there's no reason on earth other than elections coming up here, elections coming up over there, and this mad society, which is the Israeli society. So none of this has any bearing in reality. None of this has any bearing in reason. It's complete madness, and it's an expression of an empire that is about to disintegrate. That's about to disintegrate, and now all they have to show that they're strong is the ability to destroy everything around them, like this war, like the genocide in Gaza and so on. So looking for reason, looking for kind of an intellectual understanding of something that is madness, it doesn't work. I mean, you can't understand madness. That's why it's called madness, you know?
I mean, you know, and I don't want to, you know, infer, but I think you know several ex-intelligence people from the intelligence community in America, FBI, CIA. Do you think that within American intelligence, I mean, I've heard reports that the U.S. military was against this. The U.S. military establishment was fighting the Trump administration not to start this war. Do you think that slowly the American military apparatus and the intelligence apparatus is turning against this war?
Well, who knows? I mean, we don't hear about that in the news, but Trump fires anybody who doesn't agree with him. So, you know what I mean? If somebody disagrees, he got rid of them. That's how things like this operate. And that's why things like this fail, because they're done for reasons that don't make any sense. So, of course, if you're a military expert and you see this madness, you either warn or quit or remain complicit. Those are the three choices, right? And different people made different choices. Same with the intelligence community. All the whistleblowers that we know, people like John Kuriakou and Ray McGovern, you know, or two generations and many others that resign, you know, and they resign because they say, well, we don't want to be complicit and we're not heard. And this is madness and we can't be part of it. So that's what's happening. And again, the war is, I mean, this vicious attack against Iran is full blown. America can't win it. Only Iran can win this, because America, in order to win, has to, I don't know what win looks like, but there's no way America can win this. The United States can win this. Iran just has to survive to win. And to hurt the United States and to hurt targets, Zionist targets within Palestine. And they're doing that very effectively. So once again, I don't think if you have a healthy mind, you're supposed to understand madness. You can't understand madness. It's madness. That's why it's called that. And that's what we're seeing right now. And again, I'll say, it seems to me that this is the end of an era. It's, again, it's this imperial power, it's this racist ideology that realize that they're crumbling, and this is their last hurrah. This is kind of like the fireworks, if you will, before the end. There's no legitimacy to any of it.
There's a CIA analyst, I forget his name, that recently said he doesn't see Israel coming out of this, that he doesn't see Israel existing in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, I agree. There's no way Israel, no way they can win this. There is no way they can win this. I mean, they're being hit so hard. Of course, we're not hearing news of exactly where things are, you know, what targets are being hit and so forth, because there's a complete blackout. If you look at the Hebrew news, there's not a single word about anything being hit. Nothing. Only about the successes, quote unquote, of their military in Iran, killing people in Iran and eliminating people in Iran and all that kind of jargon. But there's no way that it can win. There's no way that they come out of this even remotely in a better place that they were. And I agree. I think this is the end of this. This is kind of the last few breaths of this regime.
Yeah, I believe I agree with you. I think Israel is not going to come out of this. It's not going to exist in the next 5 to 10 years.
This is This Week in Palestine, and here we learn how the end of Israel is gonna be. We follow the story until the truth shows its face.
I think one of the things that allows me to understand their motives is when we see what the Secretary of War, as he likes to call himself, Pete Hegseth, says that he's a crusader, right? He puts, you know, he has kefir on his arm, which means disbeliever, which is not something to be proud of. And
yeah,
it doesn't mean goyim in any way or anything like that. And then also Netanyahu, like, if you study history, you have to understand that madmen of the past have always had a dream, have always had a self-image, an imagination in their head of who they will become, and it's always some great destiny.
I mean, I don't know. He sees himself as you know, this great leader, I'm sure, but he is also just a power-hungry human being, a power-hungry politician. And he knows how to stay in power better than any other politician there, and so that's why he's still in power. And again, his extremism, extreme compared to what? He is not any different than all the other Israeli prime ministers in terms of ideology. In terms of rhetoric, maybe a little bit. But if you look back and you listen to what Zionist leaders have said from the beginning, he is no different. Just right now, we see it in front of our eyes. Imagine if, you know, the Nakba 1948, people had seen, you know, or during the Holocaust, if people had seen this live, how would they have responded, right? So it's a very different time. But in terms of ideology, in terms of, if you look at the makeup of the political figures within the Knesset, you know, the parliament, the Zionist parliament, there is no dissent to what is happening. Not to the war, not to the attack in Iran, of Iran, not to the genocide in Gaza, not to the ethnic cleansing in other parts of Palestine. They're all on the same page. So if there was a different prime minister, which I doubt we'll see anytime soon, but even if there was, that would change nothing. It would change nothing. Maybe the rhetoric might be a little different, but it would change nothing. They've taken, like you said, they've taken parts of Lebanon. They're probably going to stay, keep the Litani as the northern boundary, which is something they've wanted for a very long time. They've taken parts of Syria that they're very likely they're going to keep. I don't believe they will go east of the Jordan River because the Kingdom of Jordan is a very stable ally. And so I don't think they're going to do that, although a lot of them believe that they deserve it, that they should.
It's a part of greater Israel.
It's part of greater Israel, but it's not part of the consensus. It's not part of the consensus. And so, you know, and also, like I said, his ideological upbringing goes way long before his brother was killed and became a hero. I mean, his brother was a hero before he died too, but considered a hero.
I mean, I think it's often interesting how religious extremists aren't usually religious. Like, if you look at ISIS members, a lot of them don't even know anything about Islam. Yeah. So I think it could be true that he's not religious and that he has a religious extremist view of the world at the same time.
It's not religious. It's nationalistic and racist and violent. You know what I mean? I think it degrades religion when we say that that this is religion. Mm. You know, I mean,
But do you think it would help the Palestinian movement or Arab countries, or I think Iran is already on this wave, to understand that there's something spiritual happening here? When you look at the Epstein class and their sacrifices to these demonic elements, when you look at, you know, this idea of greater Israel and creating the new Judea Samaria or whatever, right, and that the many generals were telling American soldiers that this is a crusade, that this is a religious war on the ground.
Yeah.
Shouldn't then we start talking about this in a more spiritual way, like understanding, okay, well, it might be madness or it might be illogical, but it might be coming from somewhere that's not necessarily about the mind. It's more about the spirit, that they see themselves and they see Iran as Amalek and they see...
But how would you fight it differently? At the end of the day, you have to get rid of it, you know? And so giving it a spiritual... or seeing it as a spiritual expression... Makes no sense, because there's nothing spiritual about it. It's completely violence, it's racism, it's cruelty. And you know, a lot of these things that people think are, a lot of symbols that people think are religious, Jewish, they're not. They're secular, nationalistic, Zionist symbols. and one of them is Al-Aqsa. So in 1967, when the military took East Jerusalem, the commander, who later became the Army Chief of Staff, but the commander, who was completely secular Israeli, you know, stood up and said, the Temple Mount is in our hands. And that became iconic. Every Israeli knows that sentence. Everyone knows that sentence. It became iconic. Now, I grew up secular. Most Israelis grew up secular. Why would they care about the Temple Mount? It's a national symbol. Building the temple is an expression of our national aspirations as Zionists. So it's not a religious thing. The state of Israel, the Ministry of Education, sponsors education programs that teach young people how to serve in the temple. The temple is not there, right? I remember singing as a child songs about, you know, how we're going to rebuild the temple. And I think back, I went, why were we singing that? What do we care about the temple? We're almost atheist or certainly non-religious Zionist. I mean, what's that got to do with anything? It's a national, it's an expression of the Zionist desire for, you know, its own glory. And speaking of Al-Aqsa, as you know, during Ramadan, most of Ramadan, there was no access to Muslims to pray. And it's empty. I mean, the entire ground is empty. I've been there many times. It's an incredible place. I think it's more incredible, more beautiful, certainly more significant than, I don't know, the Taj Mahal or Notre Dame in Paris or the Vatican. I mean, it's older, it's more beautiful, it's got a much longer history, of course. But why has it been empty so long? If we look at the pattern, the Zionist pattern, when they want to take something, the first thing they do is they make sure Palestinians are excluded from entering the space. The next thing they do is whatever they want to do with the space, which is usually to build something for themselves. I remember being there in 2021. There was a huge uprising in 2021 and a national and a strike throughout all of Palestine. And at one point, some of the brush, some of the vegetation around Al-Aqsa in the compound caught fire. And the Al-Buraq, you know, the Western Wall is just below it. And you saw all these Zionists, young Zionists, dancing and, you know, with their flags and everything. And at the top, you saw the Golden Dome and a fire. And I thought, this is it. This is it. This is what they want. They want the place to catch fire and disappear. Or maybe a missile falls. And I've been saying this, especially I've been saying this when I speak in front of Muslim audiences. This place, if we don't act, if somebody doesn't intervene, will be destroyed. It will be destroyed. And when it is, it'll never come back. It is such a significant place for religious reasons, of course. I mean, for Muslims, of course. The history of it, how old it is, the architecture, the beauty. I mean, there's so many things culturally that go into that place that by far exceed any other of the great monuments around the world. And I've seen so many of them. And they want to ruin it. They want to destroy it. And they will if they're not stopped. And as I see the, you know, the entire Al-Aqsa grounds, the entire compound empty for this long, I'm seeing all other parts of Palestine where Palestinians were denied entry for a very long time. Then the military comes in or whoever, and they do what they want with it. And it's likely they'll make it look like an accident, an Iranian missile or a fire or, you know, something, you know. In fact, I have friends, Palestinian friends, from all over Palestine who now they can't go, but during particularly Ramadan, but in general, they would go there and spend the night to protect the place because settlers come in, you know, Zionists, young Zionists come in and try to destroy it. And they would sleep, they'd spend the night there, even when there was a lot of violence. But now nobody can enter. I'm sure the first thing that's going to happen is they're going to allow these young Zionist settlers to go in there and pray and do whatever they want before they allow Muslims. And when it's gone, it's going to be gone. That's it. You know, once it's gone, it's gone. A place like that, you can't, you know, even if you rebuild it, it's not the same. This place has a history longer than all these other places and a significance and a beauty. And, you know, I remember you always see like, you know, teachers taking their Palestinian kids from schools in Jerusalem, you know, going in there, having picnics, playing a little bit. You know, it's a very beautiful, quiet, you know, inspiring space. So people always say, oh, you know, if they do this or if they do that, the entire Muslim world will rise. And they don't. You know, they said they would do that if America, if the United States recognizes Jerusalem as a capital. They didn't. They already took the Ibrahimi Mosque and Al-Khalil, which is, you know, in terms of importance, is almost as important as Al-Aqsa. They took it. I mean, Muslims can still pray there, but the conditions are terrible and the settlers basically own it and the soldiers. So what, and I've been saying this for years, if people don't intervene, if countries don't intervene, not only will the genocide of the Palestinian people continue uninterrupted, but that gem of a place will be destroyed. And they don't care. They already have models of what they want to put instead. They have pictures. There's posters with this other thing there, which they call a temple. It's ridiculous, but instead of Al-Aqsa. You know, they talk about it, they plan it, they do these tours. And I went on several of them just to see what these people are like. And so from Al Burak, there's a bridge that goes up to the hill, to Al-Aqsa, to the compound. And in the middle, there's kind of a waiting area. And there's a model of this thing they want to build there. A very, very detailed, very large model. You know, they are, if there's one thing about the Zionists that we know, is that they plan ahead. And they're usually light years ahead of us, who care for justice and so forth, and peace and liberation. So I think it's important to emphasize this. It's important for people to realize what we're talking about. You know, certainly the loss of human beings, as we've seen in Palestine, particularly over the last couple of years, is, I mean, there are no words to describe it, right? This Al-Aqsa destroyed, it's in the planning. There's no question about that either. And if the world doesn't intervene, the genocide will go uninterrupted, and that place, this iconic, its value is immeasurable, will be destroyed.
I mean, I believe you're absolutely and 100% correct. And what I fear is exactly what you're saying, is that many people, many Muslims won't do a thing about it. I mean, we watched hundreds of thousands of people die and we didn't do anything about it.
Yeah, I mean, what are they going to do?
What are we going to do?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, what are these? So I tell people, look, as constituents, as citizens, pressure your governments not to normalize, pressure your governments to impose sanctions. It won't stop unless there are severe sanctions. Unless the Sixth Fleet is there, you know, the Sixth Fleet is a fleet in the Mediterranean, imposing a no-fly zone on Gaza, enforcing a blockade, enforcing an arms embargo. Severe measures have to be taken in order for this to stop. And if they're not taken, it's not going to stop.
Shouldn't the Arab countries lead the way in this?
How?
But how do we expect Europeans who...
Because that's the only, those are the only ones that have the power. What are Arab states going to do? We have masses of people marching on Palestine. That's not how it works. You can't cross all these different countries. The Europeans, the imperialists, the capitalists, they are the ones, the colonizers. And there is a growing sentiment in, you know, in public opinion. I mean, Spain just downgraded their diplomatic relations. Sweden seems to be following, and others. But there has to be intense action by governments.
What do you think will get us there? What do you think will completely revolutionize the European American governments?
Pressure from below. That's the only thing that ever
feeling
works.
Pressure from
not enough. Clearly not enough. As long as these governments, so what these governments do, they say, "Oh, we recognize the Palestinian state." What state? What are you recognizing? It's nonsense. You're not doing anything. You're not helping anyone. You need to recognize that the apartheid regime is illegal and must be dismantled, and then act to see it happen. and all trade, all diplomatic relations, boycott teams from the apartheid regime in the Olympics, and you know, whatever, any areas, any arenas where different countries send their delegations, they should be barred. This will not stop. We haven't seen anything yet. And I say this with a hindsight of what's been going on in Gaza since 2023, until such action happens. And it won't happen unless we, as constituents, do everything we can to push our governments in that direction.
Hmm. Is there a way for us to strategize? I mean, you mentioned how the Zionists are light years ahead in strategy than us. Well, what should we do when it comes to this to strategize? I know you're saying governments, but I mean, is there anything we can, you know, like Netanyahu and his group were writing articles strategizing that 7-country war. Is there anything that we can do on that kind of level where
we
write
can. We just
think
don't.
Tanks?
Of course we can. We just don't. We don't need think tanks. Think tanks are a waste of time. They just write stuff. We need action. Now, we need to plan strategically. And that's what really one of the reasons why we founded Palestine House of Freedom. And one of the things that we're doing is we need to think strategically. We need to understand what the objective is, what our limitations are, what their limitations are, and we need to work together strategically. And right now we're not. We're all over the place. And that's part of the problem, that we are all over the place, whereas they march to the tune, even with their differences. And there are a lot of differences between the Zionists and arguments, but they march to the tune when they're called. And we're not. We don't even have a tune, we're not even a movement, really, I think, in many ways. So that's starting to change. There are some politicians who get it. There are some attempts to get together. And again, we're hoping that this place will be that gathering place where all the different groups who do incredibly important work understand where we're going. At least agree on where we're going. And you do this part, you do this part, you do this part, we do this part, and so on, which is all important. But there is no strategizing. There is no, there's no central command. There's no central, entity. You know, South Africa, they had the South African Communist Party, they had the ANC, they worked together. Nothing happened, most things were policy was decided. Who does what was pretty much determined. I mean, it wasn't perfect. Nothing ever is, but revolutionary movements are far from perfect. But without that, we're just a bunch of little groups running around, So that's one of the things why reason we wanted to establish this place in a high-profile location with a flag and the name Palestine, with events, with a strategy for, we're building a curriculum as well that we're working on, a very serious curriculum using Palestinian sources. We do the events here focusing on Palestine, Palestinian culture, Palestinian history, Palestinian politics. People need to have the full picture. And then work towards a common goal. And right now, when you ask people, so when you say free Palestine, what do you mean? A lot of people are like, well, we're not sure, And that's the problem. We need to understand. And, what we do is we're a conduit for Palestinian voices on the ground. We're a conduit for the voices of Palestinian leaders, grassroots leaders on the ground in Palestine. This is not me or some person's idea. These are established ideas. This is an established route, if you will, and an established understanding that there's an established objective. The liberation of Palestine from apartheid, dismantling apartheid, putting in actual path for the refugees to return, actual mechanisms, not using it as a slogan. You know what I mean? Creating a real democracy in Palestine with equal rights.
So, Muslims tend to be probably your highest form or income of human capital, right? As Palestine House of Freedom, I'm guessing, right? Where that's the majority of your base. What do you think, what frustrates you as someone who's not Muslim about how the Muslim community in America organizes or the Palestinian community organizes to get stuff like this done, to protect Al-Aqsa, to make sure that we can save Al-Aqsa?
Well, to be honest,
and we, Palestinians,
we have actually had great response from different organizations, different individuals in the Muslim community, the various Muslim communities, I should say, because you know you've got different groups, different people coming from different parts of the world, and I mean, everybody can do more, but I think in terms of organizations, what the Muslims are doing, particularly in the United States, is actually incredible. We can all do more. At the same time, you know, my second book is Injustice, the story of the Holy Land Foundation. I don't know if you've heard of the Holy Land Foundation.
Yeah.
You know, that book relates what happened to that excellent organization and to five of the finest people you'll ever meet ending up in federal prison, two of them for 65 years. That was meant to scare the Muslim communities in this country, and it did, for good reason. That was the major blow, because the organization was well respected, very effective, even though it was small. You know, I can't tell you how many people I meet around the country that remember that during Ramadan they would volunteer or send checks or do whatever for the Holy Land Foundation. So when the organization was designated a terrorist was designated as an organization providing material support for terrorism, which, by the way, there's no burden of proof. The government can just decide that you and I are now supporting terrorism. So, I mean, there's nothing, it's a very easy process. And these five excellent people, excellent men that everybody respected and loved deeply, and for good reason. So three of them ended their sentence. Two of them got 15 years. They're both out of the country. Third one just ended his 20 years. And the other two, Shukri Abu Bakr, Ghassan El-Ashi, got 65 years in prison. These are the finest people you'll ever meet, you know? And there's campaigns for them and all kinds of stuff. But now, if you're a member one of the Muslim communities, how would you not be scared? How are you not going to be scared for your kids? Hell, they're scared when they go to the masjid, to the mosque. And that was the intent. So once again, when I look at that community and I see what they do and the contributions they do make for Palestine, it's not easy. And still, a lot of it gets done. So again, I think the onus is on people of privilege. Privileged people, white people. People like myself, you know, privileged communities in this country and in the West, it's on them to make the change. It's on them to use the privilege to bring about the change, to end this colonial mentality, to end this capitalist mentality, to end this massacre, this genocide of people who are not white. I mean, if Iran was a Western country, things would be different, right? It's completely, completely up to us as people who are privileged to push this as far as we can. And of course, everybody else does. I mean, there are plenty of people of color that participate in this struggle. But it's a threat for them. It's not a threat on us. It puts them in danger. It doesn't put us in danger.
Do you think we're getting close? Do you think we're getting close where white people are changing and going to act? And
a little bit. I mean, we've seen all these young Jewish organizations that are, you know, calling out the genocide, and that are again now coming out in rejecting Zionism. So we see, I mean, there is a shift in this country, in the United States. There is certainly a shift in Europe, but it's not enough, obviously, because and again, to be honest, I think the next election coming up in November and the one after that, the presidential elections, we're going to be some major changes in terms of the conversation on Palestine. It's going to be completely different than what we've seen so far. And the support for, you know, the apartheid regime and so on. But at the same time, we need to provide them with a roadmap. We need to provide them with a strategy. We need to educate them so they know what is needed, because they don't know. I mean, members of Congress, they've got their constituents, they've got their priorities, they got, you know, Palestine is maybe down the list somewhere, but they never get to it because they have constituents they have to take care of, and they have to get reelected every 2 years, so they have to raise them. You know what I mean? It's so we need to push this forward. We need to make it front and center, which is, again, why we wanted to be in a high-profile place. And, of course, we're just a few blocks from the Capitol. We're on Pennsylvania Avenue. You can't miss it. It has to be in people's face. It has to be there all the time so that they know they can come and they can get the information, and they can get reliable information here. They can get Palestinian-centered information, as opposed to all these other experts and think tanks and what have you, is white people that are experts on the lives of people who are not white, which is the norm.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's very important, and I'm curious what your curriculum is about, because even when we saw Mamdani last week, who, you know, I've enjoyed seeing as a mayor of New York, I think he's a great guy, and I think he's a great mayor, but his reaction to his wife's tweet, for example, it didn't seem like he knew how to respond correctly. Like many people said, he threw his wife under the bus and condemned her tweet, even though the tweet she liked or reposted, whatever it was.
No, she provided the art for a book by Susan Abul Hawa. Susan Abul Hawa, who's a great Palestinian writer, and I know her, she's a friend, is hated by the Zionists. And so Mamdani's wife, who's an artist, a professional artist, provided the art for the book. That's what this is about. And, you know, they said that, you know, Susan Abul Hawa called the Jews this and called the Jews that. It's complete nonsense. She's referring to these horrible acts committed by the way, Jews who are Zionists, you know, in the military and, you know, in the apartheid Zionist space. And she described them in ways that I feel are completely appropriate. You know, and I'm sure.
And you're Jewish. You're of Jewish background.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's got nothing to do with Judaism. I mean, if a Jew is a criminal, he's a criminal. I don't care if he's Jewish or not. If he's a criminal, he needs to go to jail, right? We're not going to open all the prisons and let the Jews out because they're Jews, right? Mm. It's a ridiculous kind of, you know, paradigm. So I don't know what he was asked. I didn't look at it too much. You know, it's very easy to attack somebody like that. And I'm like, whatever. But the context is important. Because what she did, she provided art. I don't think they even know each other. From what I understand, they don't even know each other. It was through the publisher and an agent. I mean, it was all very formal. Now, anti-Semitism is obviously a form of racism, right? It's racism directed at Jews. It's not this new definition that the Zionists created, which is called the IHRA definition, which everybody suddenly decided to adopt. That is nonsense. Anti-Semitism, like other forms of racism, I mean, I don't think it's an elevated form of racism. It's racism like everything, like any other form of racism. And it should be, it should be zero tolerance for it. Zionism, on the other hand, is racism, is white supremacy, is violent.
Is anti-Semitism.
Is anti-Semitic. When you read what the early Zionists said about the Jewish communities in Europe, the traditional kind of Jews, traditional religious Jews, you will not believe what they said about their own people. They would say, basically, their point was, a Zionist is the opposite of what a Jew is. And I'm quoting, you know? So what's a Zionist? Because you're talking to Jewish people, right? They had these crazy impressions of, I don't know, Greek gods or something. I don't know. But the point is that it belongs in the same column as all other forms of racism that should not be tolerated.
And there's little whispers in the history books that the Zionists funded Hitler's campaign against the Jews to scare them.
They didn't fund it, but when the Zionists had an opportunities in some cases to deal with Hitler in order to save Jews. There's a famous saying by David Ben-Gurion, who was the first Israeli prime minister. He said, if I had to choose between no Holocaust and no Israel, or Holocaust and the creation of Israel, I would choose the latter.
Wow.
That's the kind of mindset the Zionists have.
Yeah.
And when very few Holocaust survivors actually went to what became Israel, and they were treated with contempt.
Really?
Yeah.
Holocaust survivors in Israel treated with contempt.
Yes.
Why?
Because they were not masculine and militaristic and stuff like that.
They were a stain on the strong view of the Jewish chosen.
Exactly. That's why so many of them that did go left, end up leaving.
Oh, interesting.
So, Zionism is a terrible thing. There should be no tolerance for Zionism. And again, I don't know if you saw, but Susan Abel Hawa put out a video, an excellent video in response to that.
No, I did not.
Yeah, an excellent video in response to that. From the clip I saw, it doesn't sound like he was attacking her. It sounds like he was attacking the idea of using that terminology against Jews.
I see.
So, you got to put things in perspective. But her video, she put out a pretty long video on social media addressing this. And she did it in a very thoughtful and honest way. And I applaud her for that.
Do you think that Donald Trump has abandoned the America First campaign?
I don't think Donald Trump has any campaign other than Donald Trump First. Look at him. America First. How could, look at everything he's done and show me one thing that put the people who live in the United States first. Show me one thing that he's done that has prioritized the well-being of people in this country over his own profit. Show me one thing.
I don't think there is one. No.
I don't think there is one. It's all about him and his bottom line and lining up his pockets. That's the only thing. He's using all these slogans, because that's what he does. But he's never had anybody first. It's him first.
You see Professor Jiang's, that Asian professor that's come out and has all these predictions. He had three predictions so far. Two of them are right. He stands in front of that board.
Oh, yeah.
You saw how he said that Jared Kushner is the new Jeffrey Epstein?
Yeah, I saw that.
What do you think of that?
I don't know. I mean, the whole Jeffrey Epstein thing, in a way, is... It's part of white supremacy. It's been part of white supremacy going back in this country, certainly hundreds of years. What did the first colonizers do? They took little native girls and raped them and gave them all kinds of horrible diseases. What did they do with slaves? What did Thomas Jefferson do? Thomas Jefferson, his Monticello is not far from here. He was a pedophile and a rapist. And his farm, which is again right here in Virginia, he had single men working there, and they had free access to these young slave women, and the babies remained as slaves. In other words, it benefited his pocket.
Wow.
So basically, he had a farm for slaves. And he himself, there's a story of his, whatever she was, 14-year-old or whatever. And when you go to Monticello, they say, well, we don't know, maybe it was consensual. So Jeffrey Epstein is an integral part of white supremacist culture and colonial culture. In this country for sure, other countries too, but in this country for sure. From the very beginning, people are like shocked. Oh my God, what do you expect? People of power abusing their power and using helpless victims for their pleasure. What's new? And you talked about the Roman Empire. What's new? There's nothing new about this.
Do you think the greatest threat to American security right now is Greater Israel?
It doesn't have to be Greater Israel, but certainly the alliance between the Zionist regime and the United States has not benefited the United States one bit. It only exists because it benefited weapons manufacturers.
Oh yeah.
But it hasn't benefited the United States one bit. Iraq. the so-called war on terror, the war on Islam, the war on Arabs, none of this, and it's all the stems from this really just nasty, unholy alliance with this other white supremacist regime, which is the Zionist regime in Palestine.
Miko Peled, that's all the questions that I have for you. Do you have any final thoughts before we head off?
Fight for Palestine. This is the fight of our lifetime. We are all going to be judged, all of us, by our children, our grandchildren. They're going to ask us, where were you? What did you do? And so make sure you do something every day. Every day, find your niche and find a way to support the Palestinian cause.
Mr. Miko Pellet, founder and president of Palestine House of Freedom. Thank you so much for joining the Unsaudi podcast. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And if you guys would like to donate or check out or support or come visit Palestine House of Freedom, you can go on PalestineHouseOfFreedom.org. And once again, thank you guys for listening to the Unsaudi podcast. Assalamu alaikum.
And just like that, we arrive at the final breaths of this week's broadcast. The slow dimming of a lantern, the quiet settling of truth after an hour that asked much of the heart. As you step back into your day, may you carry with you the questions that refuse to be buried, the courage that refuses to fade, and the curiosity that keeps truth alive in a world that works tirelessly to silence it. I'm Arlene Russell, your host and narrator. Sharing this hour with you has been an honor, an hour grounded in clarity, in dignity, in a solidarity that does not evaporate when the headlines shift or when the cameras turn away. If something you heard today unsettled you, challenged you, or cracked open a door you didn't know existed, and if you ever feel the pull to lend your own voice to this work, know that this space will always have room for you. You can reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To you, our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, your trust, your willingness to walk this difficult path beside us. Your presence is the quiet proof that truth still matters, that memory still matters, that resistance still matters. If you missed any part of today's program, you can find us on every major platform: YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, iHeartRadio, Pocket Casts, Deezer, Overcast, Castro, Podchaser, Castbox, Player FM, Good Pods, and True Fans. You can also explore our full archive on radioforall.net and archive.org. Just search This Week in Palestine, or TWIP, and look for the image of the little girl raising her hands in the victory sign. We're also featured on Million Podcasts, a platform uplifting Arab American creators and helping listeners discover new voices. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll return next week. Until then, take care. Stay grounded. Stay steadfast. This is This Week in Palestine. This is occupied land. This is Palestine. And the call for freedom continues. Free Palestine from the river to the sea. Palestine Hurrah.